Although many moms, sisters, healthcare workers, scientists, friends, and Hollywood stars like Liz Taylor played an important role in the fight against AIDS, these incredible women are often forgotten by history.
That is, until now. In the new book, Fag Hags, Divas, and Moms, The Legacy of Straight Women in the AIDS Community, author Victoria Noe takes a first look at the women whose indispensable contributions continue to help people survive the AIDS crisis.
Listen as Victoria joins us to take a look at the wonder women who fought back and fought AIDS, and why their incredible legacy still endures today. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. We rely on the kindness of strangers. We stand on the shoulders of giants. We depend on fabulous listeners like you to make Feast of Fun happen.
We've got a couple of different ways to support the show. Visit feastoffun.com/plus or visit our Patreon at patreon.com/feastoffun, where we have new videos coming out and you can see cooking with drag queens before anyone else does.
You get to support Feast of Fun and rest assured that this one-of-a-kind, in-depth, LGBT-tastic programming gets from our little kitchen studios into your hot, delicious hands. We really rely on your financial support to make this show happen. If it wasn't for you, the listener, supporting us all these years, we wouldn't be here.
You can also make a one-time donation at feastoffun.com/donate. What's your Venmo? You got a Venmo?
We also have Venmo at Feast of Fun.
And your PayPal?
It's mail@feastoffun.com.
And your Bitcoin?
That's not a thing. Don't do that.
Money in a shoe?
We'll take American Express. Guys, we want to thank you so much for supporting Feast of Fun. And here's our feature presentation. Our guest today is author Victoria Noe, whose new book, Fag Hags, Divas, and Moms, The Legacy of Straight Women in the AIDS Community, takes a good look at the indispensable contributions women had and still do in helping people get through the AIDS crisis. Welcome to Feast of Fun, Victoria.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm having fun already.
Well, and thank you so much for bringing the delicious cinnamon rolls. It was a real treat. I haven't had those in a while, even though I'm trying to watch my waistline.
That's a Chicago thing for people who are not familiar. Ann Sather's is a sort of a Democratic stronghold, liberal, pro-gay restaurant institution in Chicago's gay neighborhood. Swedish institution.
Mm-hmm. And they have the best cinnamon rolls in town.
So I guess when you go there to eat breakfast, it's like a diner upscale
it is.
Swedish diner restaurant.
It is.
They give you cinnamon rolls on the house.
No, they don't.
They're charging you for those.
Well, it's part, you get
it's part of your meal.
Okay, well, that's what I'm saying. It's not like you have to it's all like pretty much everybody gets it.
But you can
get
an option of not. You can get like fruit instead, right? Or something, I think.
There are like communists who don't order cinnamon rolls. Yeah.
So, Victoria, thank you so much for putting together this incredible book. And of course, you know, I'm sure it's, you know, a lot of people have to say this and it's never enough. But thank you so much for your contributions to fighting the AIDS crisis.
Oh, well. Thank you for saying that. I will say the same thing that all of the women I interviewed for the book said, which is, I didn't do that much. Why do you care about this? And it's because a lot of women did a lot of things, mm-hmm. a lot of different things. Some of their contributions were huge. Some were little. Some were years ago. Some are ongoing. But that's really the secret of change, is a lot of people doing something. It doesn't have to be huge.
What was the hardest thing about living through the AIDS crisis that you fear people might forget today?
Well, I think it was the constant state of anxiety. And I mean, we're in a state of anxiety now, politically, but it was different then because it was personal. It was never knowing who you came in contact with, who would be around in a week or a month or a year. When I was on staff at Chicago House, which is a residential and support service for people with HIV and AIDS, we had a stack of books on this table, and the top book was the first one written about the AIDS Memorial Quilt, and this would have been 1989. And I remember looking down at the cover of the book, which was a photograph of several of the panels, each panel a different person who had died from AIDS, so about 12 or 16 panels on the cover. And I looked at one of them and I thought, huh, he looks familiar. But he kind of had that look that a lot of gay men had, in the same hairstyle and all that. And I thought, wow, that could be anybody that I know.
The gay clone look, right?
And, yeah, exactly. And so I opened the book and I looked at the cover credit, photo credit, and I saw David Oran's name. For some reason, I didn't notice it on the cover on his panel. And David and I had gone to college together. We'd been in the theater department at the University of Iowa and done shows together. And that's how I found out he was dead. Mm. And that was too common in those days, where you would find out kind of by accident that someone you knew was dead. Or you would see them, or you would hear that they were sick, or they were in the hospital. And a week later, their obituary would be in Windy City Times. And so it was the sort of constant state of wondering when the next shoe was going to drop.
What got you involved in AIDS in the first place? Was it your background in theater?
Well, I've had gay friends since high school because I was involved in theater. So I was always sort of on the edge of the community. When people started getting sick, when people started getting sick, I was still in the AIDS community. I wasn't directing anymore. I was doing fundraising. And most of my clients were arts organizations, small theaters or whatever. And I started getting work from small AIDS service organizations. So by 1988, most of my clients were AIDS organizations. And so it wasn't so much a conscious decision as it was a desire to do something. I remember a moment, and I can't for the life of me remember what was going on or where I was or why this popped into my head, but I thought, I don't want to look back and know that I did nothing. And that was why I was doing what I was doing.
What was it like your first foray, though, into this humanitarian issue for you?
I think it was probably just like volunteering. It was like, you know, putting money in the bucket, you know, kind of.
Was it hard fundraising for the crisis?
Well, it was a different kind of fundraising. At Chicago House, we had at least one event a week. So we had once a month, we had, we got all the bar money from the tips and everything from Little Jim's bar. And we had events at Roscoe's, and we had a dunk tank at Halsted Street Days, and we had a black tie gala. But every week there was at least one event. So I was doing a lot more events than I had done before. But the grant writing part of it and the individual donors were different because in theater, you don't have a lot of anonymous donors. Mm-hmm. And in the community at that time, there were plenty of people, I'll give you money, but do not put my name in the ad book. Do not send me anything. Do not put me on the mailing list. Mm. Just cash the check.
They were in the closet about their desire to support people.
Most of them were gay men in the closet who did not want their professional colleagues or their families to know what they were doing. Mm. And some of them were just people who wanted to do something but did not want their names attached to the cause.
Because of the stigma.
Because of the stigma. But as a straight woman, I could go into a foundation office where they said, well, we really want to give money to this cause. But it was safer for me to go in because they didn't really want to meet with anybody who had AIDS. Mm. And they equated AIDS and gay. Mm-hmm. So if a straight woman walked in there, then she's fine. She's mm-hmm. safe. So,
Victoria, why was it easier, do you think, or has been historically easier to talk about gay men's experience of HIV and AIDS than women, straight or gay, is experience of the same thing.
Well, I think that, you know, it hit first and hardest, excuse me,
in the, water?
In the gay community. There's no question about that, at least in this country. Mm-hmm. And I think that from the beginning, gay men were starting organizations to serve their friends because no one else would help them. Whether it was funeral homes or nursing homes or apartment landlords or whatever, they had to take matters into their own hands. And by doing that, they controlled the narrative. So, and then when you have people like Larry Kramer, you know, who is as outspoken as anybody has been throughout the epidemic, leading the charge, that's what's going to happen. Even within ACT UP, which I joined 6 years ago, the narrative there was drawn, was pretty much white gay men driven.
I don't, in the late 80s and early 90s, for me, at the age of 18, I got involved in ACT UP because it was the place to be. It was for a lot of queer people, it was a place for us to meet on a non-sexual, non-nightclub situation where we could talk about all these crises. And I think, you know, in terms of like fighting back against HIV and AIDS, it was much more than just a battle against a disease or a lack of government interest in fighting disease. This was us battling for our lives, a desire to be seen by the world. And in terms of, you know, maybe the difficulties in talking about women's stories in this issue is because women have had also to deal with other issues as well, birth control and sexism and so forth.
Well, you know, a lot of the women who came into ACT UP at the beginning came from the women's movement and civil rights movement as well. So they were experienced in organizing and, you know, they had a lot to teach the guys. Which they did, and they learned quickly. But I think that there were so many facets to ACT UP. You know, there were so many affinity groups. Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, and women became another affinity group, for good or bad. One of the stories in the book is about ACT UP LA and how the women's caucus within ACT UP LA had to fight to have their needs met, had to fight to control the narrative because men were coming to their meetings trying to take over. And so, you know, women have been fighting these battles forever. Mm. So why would it be any different in this community? I think that it's different now because there's more of an understanding that women, straight or not, people of color are disproportionately affected now by the epidemic, and that there's much more willingness to expand that audience and to focus on those voices so that they can be heard.
So your book, Fag Hags, Divas and Moms.
You laughed when you said that. I know. Well, everybody laughs. It's okay.
You know, I'm comfortable with the term fag, you know, if it's used by somebody.
That was not going to be the title of the book.
No, it was not?
Well, when I first started working on this book in September of 2015, that this title popped into my head, and I thought, oh, God, no, I'm not going to use fag hag. and I would apologize to women when I approached them to interview them. I would say, don't worry, this won't be the title. And they'd say, why not? That's me. And I'm like, really? And they're like, and every single woman I talked to was like, don't change the title. Do not change the title.
Well, yeah, I don't know if you're going to be able to take an ad out on Facebook with a title like this.
Well, I don't know. We'll find out, won't we?
You'll find out. But
like someone like Lori Cannon, who's well loved here in Chicago. She wears it with a mark of pride. Who she started out as a sort of a bus driver to the stars, and since then has worked with Chicago House and a lot of other organizations to provide food for people who are disadvantaged.
It's really interesting. Yeah. When I did the research, you know, there were at one time over 100 food service AIDS-focused organizations mm-hmm. around the country, the majority of which were started by straight women.
Mm.
And, you know,
because you gotta eat.
Open Hand, you know, yeah. in San Francisco, sure. God's Love We Deliver in New York, Doorways in St. Louis. And so maybe it's that nurturing mm-hmm. part, you know, that came out. But
well, like Lori says, she had she was good at delivery because she was a bus driver.
Yep.
And so she's just like, we can like plot out these things. And that's how she came into that. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting how that could happen, but I would imagine some of them probably had backgrounds in working in soup kitchens and things like that.
Well, and, you know, a lot of women came into the community then in a state of, it was a state of crisis, mm-hmm. and they wanted to do something. And most of them were not trained in anything particular. Mm. They were not necessarily researchers or nurses or social workers, anything like that. They may have just had a friend mm. or a neighbor or their hairstylist who was sick, who needed help. And they got in on a personal connection and found a way around it, found skills within themselves that maybe they didn't know they had, and adapted. When God's Love We Deliver food organization in New York started, Genga Stone went to the grocery store and she got groceries for a friend of his, for this guy, and took them to his apartment, and he was too sick to cook. And he was mad. He's like, I can't get out of bed. How am I going to fix this myself? So she went to a restaurant, got him a meal, and brought it back, and realized that was not a sustainable model. Mm. So she started this, we're going to bring cooked meals to people in their homes for them to eat.
So a lot of those sort of like meal delivery services like Blue Apron mm-hmm. owe a lot actually to these AIDS and food pantries who've sort of laid down the idea and the network of delivering groceries to and cooked meals to people's homes, actually.
Well, and it was the, you know, yeah. And now when there are, you know, fewer people at who are that sick, then delivering mm-hmm. meal components is easier. Mm. But in those days, these were people who could not get out of bed. Mm-hmm. They did not have the strength to get out of bed. They did not have anyone there to help them cook. Mm. So it was imperative for them to get food in that way.
And because it was a lot of people were dying from malnutrition.
Absolutely.
Mm.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about some of the women in the book here.
Let's talk about the setup of the book, because you outline all these chapters, and the women, you divide them into many different things. You mm-hmm. have like a chapter on volunteers, educators, the moms, the, mm-hmm. the divas, which is, you know, my favorite because it's, you know, people we, sure. we know, or the researchers.
Sure. I realize that these stories had not been told. I have friends who are in the community who are writing memoirs, who have written memoirs. There have been books and documentaries about the epidemic, and some of them exclude women completely. Some of them may have a token woman included in there, probably a lesbian, which is great. And the lesbians who stepped up and helped, especially the beginning of the epidemic, were heroes. They were saints. They were angels. I mean, and I watched them do tremendous work. Straight women are almost always left off, you know, unless it's Elizabeth Taylor or Princess Diana. But there were a lot more than them, and no one knew their stories. And so I decided to rectify history. And I also found out along the way that women's history in general does not talk about the epidemic.
Mm.
I found a book that was billed as the definitive history of women in the second half of the 20th century in the United States. There was one paragraph about the epidemic, and it was about the efforts of the women of ACT UP to change the government's definition of AIDS so that women could qualify for benefits and medical treatment. And that paragraph did not mention ACT UP or any of the women who accomplished that in their four-year fight.
Because that was a big accomplishment, because women were denied so much service because they're like, women couldn't get AIDS. You have a quote in your book that says, women don't have AIDS, they just die from AIDS.
That's right. Because women, the definition of AIDS was based on how the virus presented itself in men. Mm. So that
was the slogan. Women die faster. This is a disaster. Yeah. And there was all these like stickers with
them. Oh, there were great slogans. Yes. Yeah.
Women died four times faster from HIV and from the AIDS as a consequence of HIV infections because of the fact that our medical system was not equipped.
Well, they were not diagnosed until they had full blown AIDS. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and it was, I'll give you an example. You can keep it or not. a yeast infection. If a man has a yeast infection in his throat, that qualifies as possible HIV. If a woman has vaginal yeast infection, that didn't qualify. It does now. I mean, that was one of the parts of the definition. But it was, how it presented itself differently. Because, women get yeast infections all the time. That doesn't mean anything.
So let's talk about some actual women's names.
Sure.
Because there's some really great people in your book that might be forgotten if it wasn't for your efforts. Like Cynthia O'Neill, founder of Friends Indeed.
Cynthia was married to actor Patrick O'Neill. She lived in the Dakota apartment building with John Lennon and Yoko Ono and all them. The very definition of an Upper West Side New York socialite. And she became slowly involved in the community, as a lot of women did, through personal contact. She was very influenced by Marianne Williamson and her spiritual philosophy that was very popular in the 1980s.
Marianne Williamson?
Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with her.
Marianne Williamson, sort of like Louise Hay. I mean, a very spiritual, affirming, life-affirming, positive thinking, spirituality.
And what did Cynthia do exactly?
So Cynthia started this group called Friends Indeed, which was a support group for people with HIV. And it was one of the first ones. And it was not attached to any other organization. It was just itself. And this guy was coming to the support group's meeting. They call him the big group, coming to the support group meetings with his boyfriend to support his boyfriend. And she remembered that he was very intense and really listening to everything was going on. And she found out eventually that he was Jonathan Larson and he was writing a musical that turned out to be Rent, which is, most everyone knows, has an AIDS storyline to it and a support group that's based on Friends Indeed. Mm. He invited her to speak to the cast about her work and gave her a CD with all the music on it. And she did not get to see the show until after he died. But she has remained close with them, with the cast, Anthony Rapp, who was an original cast member.
Star of Star Trek Discovery.
Yes.
Are you watching it?
Of course.
You are? Yes. Gaze in space.
Yes.
The interesting thing, about self-help groups is, because ACT UP at the time was a place for people to find each other, to listen to each other's stories. And it became really evident for organizers that, there needed to be youth groups for LGBTQ youth. We needed HIV support groups. We needed 12-step programs for queer people. We needed a wide variety of just mental health and physical health services for ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's really what got this conversation about universal health care, which is something we still don't even have. But we've certainly made a profound changes in how we address disease and, and certainly you can argue that the contributions of a lot of these activists is why we didn't succumb to the bird flu or any of the other things, because our government in some ways understands the ramifications better of an ineptitude or inaction to dealing with an emerging health crisis, and is more likely to take quicker action today than they would have in the you know, early 80s.
Well, absolutely. And what was important too, no one was going to give these to the AIDS community. No one was going to give you anything. You had to go out and fight for it. Mm-hmm. And fighting for it meant that you had to find allies in the government who could help you. Some of them, you know, were more upfront about being supportive. Mm-hmm. Some were not. I lobbied on Capitol Hill for the first Ryan White Care Act in 1990, I think it was. And I remember at a reception, Ted Kennedy spoke, and he said, "I can't put my name on this, because if I do, there are senators who will vote against it just because my name is on it. That's why I can't be a co-sponsor." So you have to be cognizant of all those relationships going on. He fought like hell behind the scenes, but he could not put his name on as a co-sponsor. Now we have, you know, the women championing the cause. You know, Nancy Pelosi has done it since her very first speech in the House of Representatives when she was first elected. Maxine Waters, Barbara Lee, you know, they have been at the forefront of legislation and funding for programs that directly impact people in the community and people who are at risk.
Somebody who's very controversial is self-help guru, author Louise Hay. She's best known for her 1984 book, You Can Heal Your Life. Louise Hay wrote, "You had to take responsibility for your dis-ease," she liked to call.
Yes.
"Because you caused it. And if you dealt with your dis-ease, you can cure your illness." She is certainly an influential author. I can't think of anybody who contributed more to the way LGBTQ people think about their spirituality and their philosophical views in this day and age than someone like Louise Hay. She's, you know, I mean, everything about, like, RuPaul saying, "If you can't love yourself, how the hell are you going to love somebody else? Can I get an amen up in here?" That can be attributed to Louise Hay saying things like, "I'm at the right place at the right time doing the right thing. Every thought we think is creating our future." But what do you make of Louise Hay and her controversy that she had, where she was sort of almost, you know, this is the idea of Oprah's The Secret. Mm-hmm. The dark side of this is that it's almost like what some people call toxic positivity, mm-hmm. that it's sort of blaming a person for misfortune or illness in their lives.
Louise Hay was always controversial. Mm-hmm. Within the AIDS community. And I know people personally who have benefited tremendously from her teachings. And I would never discount that. I would also never discount the power of Norman Vincent Peale, the power of positive thinking. Mm-hmm. There have been studies about the effects of positive attitude in patients of suffering from various diseases. And I think that anything that can help someone is good. One of the reasons I think she was so influential was that at that time, there was so much shaming, so much stigma. This was at a time when, you know, William F. Buckley suggested that people with AIDS have tattoos, so that they could be, people would know who they were coming in contact with.
It was the scarlet letter.
Exactly.
HIV.
Exactly. So that anything, you know, all of this hatred and irrational fear was being directed at people for something that they had no control over, which was their diagnosis.
And so Louise Hay sort of changed the way people thought about that.
Well, I think that she gave a lot of people hope. She gave a lot of people faith in themselves.
To take action.
To take action for their own health. And I, not to say she didn't make a lot of money off of people, because, you know, she did. And that was the big rap against her, was that she was making all this money. And was she encouraging people to get rid of their medication? You know, was she encouraging people to do things that were harmful to themselves by following her teachings? Like I said, she's very controversial, as mm-hmm. you introduced her, you know, and well, I think that she always will be. And there are, you know, but if it works for you.
Well, you have to put yourself in the shoes of the people who are HIV positive, who are living with AIDS in the late 80s. A lot of physicians were clueless of what to deal with this and were prescribing AZT, which in hindsight was killing them faster. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in terms of Louise Hay, she put this idea out there that looking for solutions was a very healthy way to dealing with a crisis.
Well, I think any time that you can give someone the tools to be proactive mm-hmm. about their own health, that's a good thing.
And I think, I was looking at the death of Eva Perón, which we're working on a podcast about mm-hmm. that. I guess there's a documentation that she wasn't even notified. The Argentinian dictator's wife who... They made a musical about her life, Evita, mm-hmm. you know, famously. They did not notify her that she had possibly cervical or uterine cancer. Mm-hmm. They never told her she had. She was one of the first Argentinians to go on chemotherapy mm-hmm. and to deal with the pain of her illness that she did not know what was causing, mm-hmm. being caused. They try to silence her politically by mm-hmm. giving her a lobotomy. And that's what ultimately did her in.
Well, you know, and... I mentioned the irrational fear, you know, and there was a lot. The fear at the beginning was not that irrational. We didn't know at first who was at risk, how you were going to get it, how you could avoid it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was so much not known.
Well, it was a situation like, you know, you had children in elementary schools and high schools going up to each other going, don't use the bathroom in a movie theater because the toilet seats have AIDS on them, you know, like ridiculous things like that.
You know,
and I think to this day, like people are afraid to sit on a toilet seat.
Well, there's still a ridiculous percentage of people who still think that HIV is, you know, there's a difference between infectious and contagious, you know. If I sneeze on you and I have a cold, you're probably going to get a cold. If I sneeze on you and I have HIV, you're not going to get HIV. And people don't understand that. You know, a lot of that irrational fear, despite what we know now and what we have learned over the last 30 years, is still there. And some people, you know, are going to cling to that because it's important to them, you know, to cling to that. But, you know, women in the book like, you know, Ryan White's mother, Jeannie, and Louise Hay, who had three sons with HIV, all of those boys acquired it through transfusions because they were hemophiliacs. Mm. And, you know, Ryan White's grave was vandalized four times after he died. They finally had to move his body to a cemetery in a different city. Mm. Louise Hay's, the Ray family's house was burned down to get rid of the family from their community, even though they knew at the time that the kids they went to school with were not at risk. Mm. So it's, you know, they did what they could to educate their community, but not everybody wants to listen.
What about Susan Gatton and the Junior League?
Oh, yes. I think probably one of the surprising stories in this book is about the involvement of the Junior League.
Mm-hmm. I was a little surprised when I read it. I was like, I didn't know they were involved.
I was actually a member of Junior League Chicago for a few years, 20 years ago.
For people who are not familiar with the Junior League?
Pardon me?
For people who are not familiar with the Junior League?
The Junior League was a group of debutantes in New York started the Junior League. One of them was Avril Harriman, the financier's daughter. And they were debutantes, and they were looking for volunteer projects to do, and they found a project in New York that was actually based on Jane Addams' Hull House model, working with immigrants. Mm-hmm. The Junior League is committed to projects that improve the lives of children and women of all ages, all races. And in 1986, Susan Gatton was one of the first Junior League presidents to take on a project that was AIDS related, and it was a housing project, Fife House. At one time, I forget the exact number of junior leagues. There are over 140 junior leagues. About 150,000 women in four countries are members, and they do volunteer work. Sort of nothing screams straight white woman like junior league, you know. And the stereotype is, you know, the white gloves and the pearls and the whole thing. And they are far from that stereotype anymore. They are diverse. They are career women. And about the time the membership was sort of tilting toward career women was the 1980s. And in 1986 in San Francisco, the junior league there started working with Shanti Project, which is a support program for people with AIDS. In fact, the first check from a non-AIDS or LGBT organization that Shanti Project received was from the Junior League.
You quote Susan. She wrote a letter saying, "Our city has never faced a more formidable foe. More San Franciscans have already died of AIDS than were killed in the great earthquake of 1906.
Right.
Yeah.
They were very, you know, and again, hers started with a personal contact. A personal contact with someone who died from AIDS, as many of us had in those days. But they went on to do a lot. You know, they're involved mostly now with the AIDS Memorial Grove. They're
What is that?
The AIDS Memorial Grove in San Francisco is a memorial garden for people who have died from AIDS. 2 years ago, I believe it was, they added people who died of AIDS who were hemophiliacs. There's a special section for them. And it's a memorial garden.
We're getting one here in Chicago.
Yes, I'm on the committee for that.
Are you really?
Actually, yes.
By the Belmont Rocks?
Which it's going to be by the rocks, of course. I mean, where else would it be? And it'll be a garden and a Keith Haring sculpture.
Oh, wow.
And originally, for people who may not be familiar, the Belmont Rocks was the gay cruising place, the gay congregation place.
I did not spend much time there, no.
Yeah. But it was popular right at the after the Stonewall riots. So in the 70s and 80s, it was the place. Even when I first moved to Chicago in the mid-90s, it was
I think they have pictures of gay guys hanging out there from the 50s and 60s, And it was just an area.
Well, you have to talk to Owen Keenan about that.
We did a show about that.
But if you just search Belmont Rocks on the web, on Vista Fun, you will definitely find it.
But impressive upon me that these you know, so aristocratic women like Cynthia O'Neill or Susan Gatton, or, you know, certainly like Elizabeth Taylor, all sort of got involved with HIV and AIDS because of their experiences in knowing gay men who are dying of AIDS.
Exactly. And remember, at this time, there was no advantage for any of them to get involved. There was no social advantage. There was no business advantage.
Well, who's going to do their hair and decorate their homes, right?
Well, it was
that's
something.
That's not what I mean.
It was a stigma. They were putting themselves in harm's way themselves.
Exactly.
Obviously, not as dangerous.
Their businesses could suffer.
Sure.
They would lose friends, and they did.
But they felt like they had no other choice. You know, they were seeing people that they cared about dropping dead because of apathy, because of ignorance and bigotry. And so they felt they had to take an action.
The Junior League in San Francisco is extraordinarily generous in going through their archives for me. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they sent me was their monthly magazine that they send out to their members. And the issue from January 1989, about a third of the magazine is devoted to AIDS. AIDS education, AIDS projects they were working on, statistic, just all kinds of things. The cover is of the quilt, is the AIDS quilt. And inside is a letter, an open letter to the membership from one of their sustaining members. A sustaining member is someone who's sort of retired, like they're not as involved anymore, but they're still members. And it was from a woman whose husband had died from AIDS. And it was an anonymous letter. And she talked about the fear that her family had that anyone would find out. Mm-hmm. That even people in their family did not know what how her husband died or why he died. And the isolation that she felt. And at the end of the letter, she said, you know, she wasn't going to sign her name, but she offered, if anyone wants to reach out to me, you know, the Junior League office knows how to get in touch with me, and I'm glad to talk to you or help you. And I thought that it was a beautiful, incredibly sad letter that even among friends, among women who she had, you know, as a sustainer, she would have been a volunteer for probably a couple decades already. Women she had known and worked with for years that she did not feel comfortable signing her name. And that's what it was like.
What about women of color or Latinx women like Iris de la Cruz?
Iris was an activist in New York. Iris House, which is a program in West Harlem, is named after her, started by her mother, who passed a couple years ago. Here in Chicago, Rosa Martinez Colon has worked with Calor on the West Side since the 90s. Ray Lewis Thornton, who announced a woman who's African American, announced her HIV diagnosis on the cover of Essence magazine, 1990, January 1990 issue, I believe. They were very and are very brave to do what they do. Because in their communities, it was even more difficult to talk about HIV than in the general population, just on, you know, mainstream media.
Because they were outsiders because they were women. And
absolutely. Also,
and women of color.
Absolutely. There was an organization based on the South Side called the Red Pump Project that did this great. They dissolved the organization last summer, unfortunately, but they focused on cities that were not New York and L.A. So Chicago, Washington, D.C., I forget where in North Carolina, but they would do events. And the best event they did, which I went to a couple times, though I wasn't their audience, was called Condoms and Cupcakes, and which is the best title for a fundraising event,
sure.
Any kind of event, you know. And they would have tables full of red velvet cupcakes, and they would do sex ed sessions for women of color. And they did condom demonstrations. Mm-hmm. They talked about PrEP. They talked about all kinds of things. And you got cupcakes, you know, so what could be better? Mm. You have to, you know, there are women who understand that they have to focus on their own communities, and they are the best people to do it. Because they can talk about what it's like to talk to your husband or your boyfriend about using a condom. They can talk to them about where they can get PrEP, where they can get tested, where they can get treatment within their communities. And that's what's so exciting to me. It's that, you know, we've sort of gone from the Elizabeth Taylor diva, you know, rich white woman, straight stereotype, to women of color impacting their communities because they know that's where they're who's at risk. I think it's great.
But is there a lot of funding or talking about where do we reach people, especially people of color, you know, especially for queer people? We're not going to our churches. And a lot of us sort of are living in parts of town that we don't have access to these sort of gay community centers. And part of it is just like we're usually watching T.S. Madison on Facebook. And, you know, like in an ideal world, it seems like and there's been studies about this now that there's a luxury of meeting face to face with another person that disadvantaged communities don't have. And so in some ways we think of our smartphones and our computers as these luxury devices, but the ability to not have one is now becoming the luxury. It's now we're required to be on these screens and interacting with each other as opposed to being in physical spaces. So if we want to reach these disadvantaged communities now, that's where we need to go.
I think that it's important to find out how people get their information. Mm-hmm. And every community is different. Every age, every demographic is different. And once you find out how they get from information, that's where you have to focus. And it's also very different in rural communities and smaller towns where transportation is the main access issue. You know, you don't walk out the door and get, you know, walk two blocks and get on the L to go downtown. Mm. You know, if you don't have a car in a rural community, how do you get around? Because there's no public transportation. So you have to figure out how to reach people where they are. Who's effective at doing it? Maybe it's a church. Maybe it's a community center. Maybe it's a sports team.
Do you think that maybe the success of women and impacting HIV and AIDS and changing perceptions and addressing these crises is because women traditionally have been seen as sort of caregivers and in some ways more neutral in you know, the idea of a sexually transmitted disease or a disease that may be transmitted through blood infusions or sharing needles? Is something that if a man is saying that message is not as trusted as if it is a woman saying it.
I think straight women have an advantage in that we are sort of looked at as, I don't know about neutral, but safe. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's a maternal aspect is assumed. And caregiving is, you know, I mean, when I would talk to people about the book and I would talk about it with straight men in the community, and there were people who assumed I was talking about caregivers, that I was talking about, you know, someone coming to your home and, you know, doing your laundry or whatever. And I'm like, no, I'm talking about people who, you know, discovered the HIV virus and,
speaking of,
there were lots of ways that. Mm-hmm. That we impacted the community. And I think that the fact that we were not seen usually as a threat to anyone was a great advantage. It still is. Mm.
You're sneaky that way.
You mentioned some of the researchers, and you mentioned Françoise Barré-Sinoussi, who shared the Nobel Prize with Dr. Luc Montagnier from the Pasteur Institute in Paris, who did a remarkable work on the AIDS virus early on. Mm-hmm. And at one point in time, when treatment was found out, she became depressed.
Yes. It's not uncommon. Mm-hmm. It was not uncommon. But I think that it was surprising to hear her use those words to describe it, because and as someone says to her, oh, you too, you know, I think everybody went through that at some point, sometimes more than one point. When things get good, you know, when the antiretrovirals came in, everyone was supposed to be happy. Mm-hmm. You should be happy. These drugs are here now. And instead it was like, I've been going at 100 miles an hour for the last 15 years, and now you put the brakes on. What do I do now? What do I do with myself now? Mm. You know, there was a feeling among some people they'd lost their purpose, sense of purpose. Mm-hmm. They'd certainly lost the sense of urgency.
It's like a postpartum.
Almost, yeah. Almost, yeah. It's like the hard work is over. Now what do I do?
Mm. What do you think make of sort of the phenomenon of PrEP? We were talking before we started taping that very much the conversation on PrEP is the same conversation people are having about birth control in the 50s all over again.
Well, PrEP, of course, is pre-exposure prophylaxis. It's, you could take a pill a day to prevent infection. If someone had told me 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years ago there would be a pill you could take every day and not get infected, I would have said, yeah, what are you smoking? You know, because that's never going to happen. It's huge. It's not for everybody. I understand that some people have complications with it. I understand that. Some people can't or won't take it every day, which is how it's most effective. But the idea of shaming someone for using it rather than using a condom is just beyond me. It's what straight women went through with the pill. It was like, if you're on the pill, you must be a slut. The same with gay men on PrEP.
Well, and we're also seeing, like, you know, these predictably these right wingers who really have no vest. You know, they can make the argument, well, you know, if we put women on birth control, we're preventing a life from taking place. And so a lot of Hobby Lobby famously wants to deny women health care completely because they might be able to get birth control. And now they're sort of making that argument against, you know, anybody who can be exposed to HIV. Mm-hmm. So effectively in the United States in this day and age, the right wing is against healthcare and on any level for anybody, because anybody can become HIV positive.
Exactly.
So giving healthcare to people means getting them access to this medication.
Well, and it's why everything is connected. Everything is connected. I went on Medicare last year, and just for the hell of it, I went on my Part D to see how much Truvada PrEP cost. And I have a pretty good plan. And after, you know, I meet the deductible, it would be $400 a month.
And you're on Medicare.
And I'm on Medicare. And that's one of the lower prices I've heard for, you know, and I've heard $700 on Medicare. I guess it depends on, you know, the plan, the Part D plan that you have. And I thought, $400 a month, you know, I don't have a lot of monthly bills that are more than $400 a month. Let's talk about, there's this great pill that people can't afford to take. When AZT came out, it was $10,000 a year.
And it didn't even work.
$10,000 a year for AZT.
Are you adjusting for inflation?
No, that's what it was then.
Okay, so that, by today's standards, it would be a higher
amount. Oh, my God, yeah. Yes. Much, much more. And, you know, the medical advances are great. But if people can't afford them, if they're priced so high, if the pharmaceutical companies are making billions of dollars off of this, and maybe they'll give you this little copay coupon, so you only have to pay half of that a month.
I think depending on what you're thinking, you know, people really have to look into it and talk to your healthcare providers.
Absolutely.
And they do have a lot of options. There's a lot of people that don't pay anything for the PrEP, depending on what kind of insurance you have. If you do have insurance, it's all
and
about access.
And it shouldn't vary so much. You know, there shouldn't be that variation.
Right. Yeah.
If you're a human being, you should have access to this, period.
And so if you get turned down by one thing, just look for another. It's out there.
Exactly.
There's a lot of resources online that can help you with that kind of stuff like that.
Exactly.
Victoria, if you want me to get you, I can get you the hookup on the PrEP.
No, thank you. I'm fine.
Well, that is a concern, though, for a lot of people don't think of seniors as sexually active.
Oh, that's absolutely true. Mm-hmm.
And retirement communities and homes do have their own sort of HIV and AIDS crisis.
They do. And, you know, about 3 or 4 years ago, I was out in L.A. and I was meeting with a young AIDS activist, a young African-American gay man, and I said, you know, my demographic is at risk too. And he said, why? And I said, I can't get pregnant. I don't need to use a condom. And he almost fell off his chair. He's like, what are you talking about? I said, you know, people my age, you know, it's retirement homes. Mm-hmm. There was a retirement home in Harlem where there was an HIV outbreak. Mm-hmm. A man moved in. If a man moves into a retirement community and he's unattached, wow. And he slept with a lot of the women in the retirement community, and they all turned up HIV positive because no one thought that they would be at risk. I was single throughout the 80s until 1994, and to this day, I have never had a doctor ask me if I wanted an HIV test because they didn't think I was at risk. I asked for HIV tests, and when I did, I was asked, why? What are you doing? I'm having sex.
Other people who may be exposed to
exactly,
HIV.
Exactly.
As a human being, as a sexually active human being, I am at risk.
And I'm risk averse to that sort of thing, you know. But, you know, it was just, I know I'm not the only straight woman who had that experience. You know, I knew, I interviewed women who said, you know, their doctors are like, why do you want this test? What do you, you know, are you doing drugs? Are you shooting up drugs? You know, it was never a sense that they were at risk because they were straight.
And also, too, it's, you know, it's you taking charge of your own health care.
Sure.
And, you know, what do you know about health care?
Which I think that's one of the great lessons of ACT UP and the AIDS community is how, you know, starting with the Denver principles that outlined, you know, the rights they expected as patients in working in conjunction with their medical providers. I think it was world chattering. I mean, it just, there was, that didn't happen before, you know?
You did talk about this in the book with the Denver principles, and you said, reading this from a 21st century vantage point, one must wonder how these demands could be considered controversial. In 1983, however, this proud visibility and determination by people with AIDS was new. The medical community had no previous experience with proactive patients who were creating a new dynamic of care.
Exactly. You know, the red ribbon came first, then the pink ribbon. I mean, look at the activism in the breast cancer community, ovarian cancer community, you know, all these different communities. That kind of activism is all built on what the AIDS community started. When my mother was dying last year, I went to battle with her doctors, and I had no problem at all doing that. And at one point, the doctors finally left the room, and the chaplain turned to me and said, you know, I think maybe your AIDS experience has helped you do this. And he was right, because I knew how to stand up for her rights. I know how to stand up for my rights in a medical sense. And I think that we learned this from the people at the beginning of the epidemic.
What advice would you give to somebody who's going through a challenge in their health crisis and dealing with the medical establishment?
Like, educate yourself.
Educate yourself.
And find your community. Mm. You know, people make fun of Facebook, you know, all the time, but there are communities, there are groups out there that will help you. 10 years ago, I had a concussion. And for the first 5 years, I was sort of on my own. The doctors, you know, didn't take me seriously because I wasn't a professional hockey player or something. And it took me 5 years to find a doctor and therapist who would help me, which they did. And I also found a group on Facebook that is just women who have had concussions. And our issues are different than men. Women have longer-term effects from concussions than men do. Mm-hmm. They present in different ways. What does that sound like? Mm-hmm. And that finding community is absolutely critical for mental health. Mm. You know, you can educate on the specifics of whatever your ailment is, whether it's HIV, whether it's cancer, whatever it is, you can educate yourself on that, but you have to find a community. And that's what we did, you know, in the AIDS epidemic, and we still do.
Lastly, we're going to talk about the divas. You got Elizabeth Taylor, Princess Diana, Joan and Melissa Rivers, Rita Moreno, Donna Mills, Taraji P. Henson, Solange Knowles.
Yes, there are a lot of them, aren't there?
Well, we gays love our divas.
You know,
and the divas love their gays.
You know,
ka-ching.
And again, you know, these are women who were affected from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. Family members and friends and colleagues who were HIV positive, who died, who they took care of, who they raised money for. And for them, for Elizabeth Taylor, you know, I mean, she says, you know, at one point, no, I've never heard so many no's in my life that people would not support her fundraising events because they did not want to be associated. There was no upside in the 1980s and early 90s. There was no upside to being associated with this epidemic.
Mm. Well, that's why Elizabeth Taylor came out with that god-awful perfume diamonds.
Well, yeah.
Because
it still funds it to this day.
Yeah.
It still does. It still does. And she was a very savvy businesswoman.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher and, you know, Melissa Rivers and Joan Rivers, you know, so it was generational as well. It wasn't just, you know, Elizabeth Taylor. And they really, they used their celebrity, as Elizabeth Taylor said, finally for something good. You know, celebrity, you know, probably killed Princess Diana, you know, and it affected all of them in negative ways. You know, they had to go through life with their personal lives on the front page of the newspapers. Now they could turn the tables and use that celebrity for something good. Mm. And they jumped into it.
So these women felt at that time in their lives that the attention that was bestowed upon them because of their careers was uncontrollable. And so this sort of put them in a position of power.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It empowered them to make a positive change for the world.
Well, like Liz Taylor, her first event to raise money, Commitment to Life, raised $1.3 million, which is more money than the CDC had spent on the epidemic in its first year.
Can we talk?
Yeah.
Well, and she was her mother was a Republican.
Elizabeth Taylor.
No, I'm Melissa Rivers, Joan Rivers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it was amazing. The money that some of these events could raise was just staggering, you know. But remember, this is at a time when government funding was not keeping up, when we had to beg for every dollar from the government, whether it was state, county, local, or federal. It was not a faucet you could turn on and all the money came out. It was not like that. So they were making up for what the government was not doing, and they were very good at it. They're still, I mean, the ones who are doing it are still very good at it.
Elizabeth Taylor's doing it from beyond the grave.
Well, you know, her children and grandchildren and great-grandson are so involved with her foundation, and they sponsor AIDS Watch, which is next week in Washington, D.C., where they train people for a day, and then they go up on the Hill and they lobby their representatives in the House and in the Senate for funding. And, you know, we have a 2020 budget now that's cut money from PEPFAR, you know, from various programs, even while saying they're going to end the epidemic by 2030. Now, I will be the first one to say I was wrong if we get to 2030 and the epidemic's over. But I've heard these stories before, and the talk and the action have to meet. They can't be opposite.
There's a lot of hype, and we see this, you know, in people who work in media. Is and Mark certainly talks about that all the time. It's like, if I see one more headline that says, we cured AIDS, or, you know, and you're always like, to the point
look
that...
Look at the news source.
You look at the news source. What do you make of Trump saying that, you know, he wants to get rid of HIV and AIDS, but he's destroying funding? Anybody who's self-respecting or knows anything what they're talking about, healthcare has quit. I mean, you know, it's certainly if, for somebody who's out to sort of destabilize their country, Trump's pretty good at doing that economically, and certainly HIV and AIDS, defunding it and destroying our healthcare system also has a chance to destabilize us as well.
Well, you know, there's a difference between authorizing and appropriating when it comes to Congress. And, you know, if he makes these declarations, then the money has to be there to back them up.
And there's no money there.
And, you know, if he's, you know, cutting Medicare, you know, wants to eliminate the Affordable Care Act as of yesterday, if he's cutting funding for CDC and all these programs, then it's not going to happen. I found it interesting that that original announcement targeted specific counties in the U.S. As being high risk. And they are. So someone there knows something about what's going on. The question is, will the money follow these announcements? And so far, there's no indication of it. And like I said, I will be the first one to admit I was wrong, you know, and that he was able to do it, you know. But I'm a little more cynical than that right now.
Well, he better hurry before he gets impeached or arrested. One thing that you posted on Twitter, which I thought was very interesting, is your Google search for why are writers, and Google automatically fills it in, alcoholics, always cold, crazy, depressed, sad, miserable, so weird. There's a saying that Cervantes, who wrote Don Quixote, and it's very quoted in Latin America. There's nothing so no hay tan mal que no bien no venga. There's nothing so bad that no good can come of it. That in every crisis, every calamity, there's always a silver lining of people coming together and overcoming their differences to grow, to show the best of humanity. Do you think, you know, 30, 40 years of AIDS has been able to do that, to be able to bring out the best in our own community?
there are those of us who talk about the epidemic who have been accused of being nostalgic for the old days. Mm-hmm. I am not nostalgic for those days. I'm not nostalgic for newspapers full of obituaries of people who died from AIDS. I'm not nostalgic for that. But there was an undeniable sense of community and purpose that's kind of lacking now. You knew that whatever your differences were, you were united in a common cause. And a common cause with a lot of urgency because your friends were dying and dying pretty quickly and pretty horribly. I think that those of us who work in the community now or in the old days or whenever are better for having done it. I mean, I feel like I'm a better person for having done that, for being involved. And I see it in my friends, too, especially the long-term survivors. They may be struggling right now, wondering why they're still alive and their friends aren't. But they are remarkable people, and they have survived a lot. And I admire them more than I can say. I try to tell them that I do. I just think there's a real bond between the people in the community that would not have been there without the AIDS crisis.
Victoria Noe, you're such a beautiful person, and I absolutely love you telling these really emotionally difficult, powerful, and inspiring stories in your book.
Thank you.
It's a real honor to have you here on Feast of
Fun. Oh, thank you.
Glad you could make
it. It's been a pleasure.
The book, Fag Hags, Divas, and Moms, is available where books are sold. I'll put a link in our website.
It officially goes on sale Friday, March 29th, wherever you buy books.
And that was not me. Hey, this is the plug. Plug in, Bell. Plug your book.
Plug.
Fag Hags, Divas, and Moms. Right. The Legacy of Straight Women in the AIDS Community. Pre-order it on Amazon or through our website, links, feastoffun.com. Mm-hmm.
And I want to remind folks that we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus, because your contribution to the show is what makes the show happen. We also have a brand new Patreon that you can access at patreon.com/feastoffun.
Where you can listen to all the podcasts before everybody else gets to do that. So you get to hear it fresh out of our oven. First on Feast of Fun. It's interesting in the history of what we've been doing and seeing how the public consciousness of the word plus and a plus sign has changed to mean subscription services that are helping to fund or to, because online media right now is, you know, in terms of advertising is dead in major, advertising on social media is certainly living and on Facebook and certainly Google search engines. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, if you're a content creator, it's got to be listener supported or viewer supported. Otherwise, it doesn't happen.
Right.
And we pioneered that using the term feastoffun.com/plus many years ago. Some of our first interviews was Sharon Needles from RuPaul's Drag Race talking about her experience. And we were putting that behind a paywall as a way to exist here, to be able to tell all these stories. And when we first came up with the title, with the what we were going to name this sort of premium experience for our listeners, we had a lot of deliberation on the word plus. Mm-hmm. It was like we were kind of, I don't know, it's, might have a negative stigma. People might think it's something to do with HIV and AIDS, And we're like, plus is a beautiful word. And for the people that we've known who have been HIV positive, they're been some of the most courageous, brilliant and intelligent people in our communities that we've seen struggle. Some of them are no longer with us and some of them are still here today. Causing a commotion. Yes. So plus is a beautiful word. I love to see it mainstreamed. It is so.
I don't know if but Apple products just announced Apple Plus.
Yes.
And we're like, hey, where'd they get that idea from?
And I'm seeing just so many, services online just calling themselves, branding themselves as plus. And I don't know where people get those ideas from, but if you are borrowing ideas from us, people are going to borrow or steal ideas from you. Make good ideas worth stealing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And Victoria,
steal from the best.
Steal from the best and steal good ideas.
Yeah.
Victoria Noe, Fag Hags, Divas, and Moms, it's real pleasure having you. And I hope that your book can inspire other people to have women and other disenfranchised or voices that are not necessarily always heard or magnified tell their stories as well.
That's my goal for the book.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Bye, everybody.
Bye.